Welcome to All Things Public Health with Alvin Kapitako. On this show, we bring you expert interviews, discussions, and stories about public health. Join us as we explore public health topics that are of interest to you, our esteemed listener.
Welcome to this first episode of the All Things Public Health podcast. My guest today will talk about how Project Hope Namibia has contributed to the fight against HIV and AIDS, and especially amongst vulnerable populations.
My name is Roseanne Kavure, and I've been working with Project Hope for about 5 years now. For the past 4 years or so, I was leading the economic strengthening efforts of the organization, and now I've moved into a role called Private Sector Engagement Specialist, so I'm leading the private sector engagement efforts.
And just touch a little bit on what you do.
Sure. So I work as I work in support of adolescent girls and young women who were trying to empower with economic strengthening skills in order to better protect themselves from HIV infections in their lives.
You could just talk to me about why Project Hope was established, and also the impact that it has had in communities, especially since the early 2000s.
We were founded in Namibia in 2002, and the first few projects that we took on were sort of small-scale workplace HIV programs in the country. And as time has gone by, we've really scaled up those efforts. So our focus has always been HIV, prevention and care and treatment. And we work very much on a community level, but we also are large enough now to take on big enough projects that really work with government and other major institutions to enact policy change and support on that higher level as well.
Okay, where are you based?
So we have a footprint in 6 regions, that is Comas, Oshikoto, Zambezi, Oshana, Omsati, and Ohangwena. These regions were selected because they have the highest HIV burden and they also have the highest population levels. So this is where most people that are at risk or living with HIV are situated. But Project Hope Namibia has also started implementing COVID-related programs in North Africa. We also implement violence...
Is that North Africa?
North Africa.
Okay.
We also implement violence against children programs here in Namibia. So we've got sort of various public health interests.
Talk to me about your current projects and how are these different or similar from the previous projects that you had? And also how long will the projects run and what do you aim to achieve?
Sure. So our newest project that we just got awarded this year is called REACH. And this is
REACH,
R-E-A-C-H. This is all around reducing HIV vulnerabilities amongst youth and adolescents. So to give a little bit of context, the previous massive projects that Project Hope were implementing were called DREAMS and NARP. So DREAMS stands for Determined, Resilient, Empowered, AIDS-Free, Mentored and Safe. And this is the program that I was working on leading the economic strengthening efforts. And this was really all about preventing HIV infections in adolescent girls and young women. Mm-hmm. So all the efforts were about linking HIV negative girls and young women who were vulnerable to becoming HIV positive to services that would help protect them. The other project that Project Hope has been implementing is called NARP, which is the Namibia Adherence and Retention Program. So NARP was all about providing care and treatment specifically to like orphans and vulnerable children and their caregivers. So we had the care and treatment element and then we had the prevention element. REACH is sort of a culmination of those two programs. So just to give that context, we have an element with providing care and treatment to orphans and vulnerable children and their caregivers, as well as the HIV prevention efforts that we champion through DREAMS. So the kinds of services that we provide through REACH are clinical services. So we're linking young people to HIV testing, as well as like family planning, PrEP initiation, so that daily pill that you can take to prevent HIV. And then we also have social services. So young people will be able to be linked to social services or social workers rather, where they can talk about any GBV that they're experiencing. We do things like taking household hunger assessments to assess the vulnerability of the household and things like that. And then we also have economic strengthening services, which is the part that I work on. So we link young people, especially girls and young women, but we're also expanding to boys and their caregivers, to things like financial literacy training so that they can understand how to save, what is debt, that kind of thing. We also link them to vocational training opportunities. So we've linked young girls to training in, it could be more traditional avenues like clothing production and hospitality, but also male-dominated fields like joinery and electrical skills and bricklaying and things like that. We work with youth of different ages. So we have like OVC that would be under the age of 17, the orphans and vulnerable children, their caregivers. Adolescent girls and young women would be between the ages of about 10 and 24. And then, so within each kind of segment or age group, it's an age-appropriate service. So there are also different eligibility criteria that they need to meet in order to receive the services that best suit them. So it's quite a targeted approach.
But how long will they run though?
Oh, okay. So NARP ran for 10 years. Dreams overlapped with NARP for the last 5 years of those, and REACH is going to run for the next 5 years. So they tend to run in sort of 5 year cycles. And like I said, we just began REACH this year. So in 5 years, 2028. But with organizations like Project Hope that have been around for quite some time, new projects come up, you know, old projects end, and we sort of flow into whatever the public health concerns are at the time.
And so you will be working with young people still?
Absolutely.
Okay, in the same regions?
So Dreams was only in three of the regions that I mentioned. Dreams was only in Komas, Oshikoto and Zambezi. And now we've also expanded to Omsati and Ohangwena and Oshana.
So we are doing very well, like in terms of, you know, controlling HIV. And I think the last time I read was that we are nearing epidemic control. So what would you attribute this to?
Sure. So yeah, we are nearing epidemic control, and Namibia is one of the only high risk countries or high burden countries to have gotten this far. So we are doing incredibly well. And I think it's mostly attributed to the prioritization that government has made of this issue. So we've dedicated a really large percentage of our annual budget and our GDP is directed towards public health efforts, in mm-hmm. particular with HIV. And then we also have quite significant support from the US government. They've been supporting HIV care and treatment, HIV prevention programs for the last 10, 15 years or so. So that's been a really big push towards achieving this this epidemic control.
And why do we still have new infections?
HIV is a really tricky illness. It has social dynamics as well as pathological. So it's not just a virus that you contract in a vacuum. It's something that relates to people's like social experiences of the world. So their economic status, their sort of family life, links to whether or not they're at risk of HIV. So the reason why we're still seeing HIV infections is because until we also solve those societal issues, we're not really able to say that everyone is equal and everyone thus is equally protected from the virus.
Why do we still have people dying from AIDS mm-hmm. despite ARVs being available?
Right. So in order for someone to protect themselves from AIDS, we're assuming now the person is living with HIV, and you know, I think your question is why do they still die of AIDS. So first of all, they need to get tested for HIV, which in and of itself can be complicated or difficult for some people. So they need to have an HIV test. If they receive a positive result, they need to accept the positive result and go on ARVs immediately. And then once they're on ARVs, it's not necessarily a simple system. They need to adhere to the medication, and that requires certain lifestyle changes. So they need to have food availability in the house. They need to maintain a healthy lifestyle and make some changes to help them be adherent on the medication. And then once they've adhered to the medication, we're hoping that their viral load reduces. So once they have a low viral load, they're likely able to live a long and healthy life. So it's not simply availability of ARVs, but also, you know, people getting tested and whatnot. And then in terms of availability, I think we've done really well to make sure ARVs are available, but that in itself can be really complicated because we have such a vast country with such a low population. So making sure that ARVs are available in every single clinic isn't an easy feat.
One thing I've read is that men are refusing to get tested. Why is that? And what initiatives are out there to encourage men to get tested?
Right. So men are incredibly hesitant to get tested. We don't see the testing numbers in men that we see in women. And I think that it's partly because we live in a patriarchal society in which men are taught to be strong, to suppress, you know, emotions, to suppress weakness. So I think that there are lots of men that see illness or see health-seeking behavior as womanly and weak. They feel that a strong man doesn't get sick, a strong man doesn't feel pain, you know. So I think it all speaks to their health-seeking behavior, which if it's seen as womanly or if it's not seen as manly, then, you know, it doesn't appeal to their understanding that they have to be a strong man. Mm-hmm. So I think it's imperative that we change this narrative, and men need to be taught that it's okay to seek healthcare. It's okay to be concerned about your health and to do something about it. And it's not, you know, it's manly, in fact, to take care of themselves. So one of the things that Project Hope has been doing is we employ male champions who implement coaching boys into men programs in which they have these kinds of conversations about what it means to be a man and what it means to take care of themselves. They go into communities and they have conversations where they educate their male community members around issues of HIV and GBV. So I think it's about breaking that stereotype that seeking health care is not manly.
And then can you talk to me about stigma, HIV stigma in the country?
Yeah.
I know that it's not the same as like in the early 2000s, like people would not drink from the same cup as someone that was HIV positive, but what forms has it taken on now, if at all?
Sure. So yes, definitely stigma is, you know, I think public health professionals have argued that stigma is probably the number one reason, you know, HIV is still such a problem. And it's because, so the form that it's taken on now is maybe people are more aware of, you know, how you can get HIV and how they can protect themselves. So they might not be as hesitant about sharing utensils with someone. But I think there's still a lot of judgment and sort of moralizing people that are living with HIV because there are assumptions made as to how they acquired the illness. So because of that, they accuse people living with HIV as having promiscuity or, you know, various other behaviors that is incorrect, first of all, and very, very damaging. So what we see is that people are hesitant to get tested for HIV in the first place. They're hesitant to take their medication. They're hesitant to even walk around with a pill box because apparently people can hear the pills rattling around in the box. They're hesitant to send their children to school with a box. Even if they do take the pill boxes to school, children are hesitant to take the pills. And it's all because of stigma. We don't see any other illness, people being hesitant to take any other medication. When it comes to HIV medication, people are hesitant to do so because of this moralizing that we have projected onto, you know, their assumed behaviors. And that stigma at the end of the day. So I think it's taken on the shape of people not wanting to get tested and then people still wanting to keep their status a secret because of this.
And I'm just wondering, like, how it is for LGBTQ plus communities as well.
Absolutely. I think that back in the day when HIV sort of came out, it was a gay disease. And so, you know, the LGBTQ community have borne the brunt of sort of being responsible for this virus, which is not the case. And I think that people in queer communities are already ostracized and oppressed enough as it is. So if, you know, if they're living with HIV or dealing with HIV, it's like a double burden of, you know, society's judgment.
What services, or how have the services that Project Hope provide, like, impacted communities at the grassroots levels, and how to reach communities as well?
Sure. So I think one of the things that Project Hope is best at is treating the sort of comprehensive and holistic vulnerabilities to HIV. So we have linked the most at-risk populations, which are young girls and women, or girls and young women rather, to services that are not purely biomedical. So, you know, yes, they have access to clinical services like HIV testing or condom provision, or, you know, initiation onto PrEP, but they've also been linked to social protection services. So my portfolio with Project Hope is I lead the economic strengthening services that we deliver to vulnerable young women. So it's a very targeted approach. We only serve the young women with these services that absolutely need it. And they've been able to receive vocational training, job skills courses, business startup kits and job placements. And this means that they're better able to lift themselves out of extreme poverty. They're better able to, you know, be independent. And when they're independent and they're not dependent on a male sexual partner, it means that they can negotiate safer sex practices. They can remove themselves from abusive relationships, so they don't have to depend on transactional sex. So I think Project Hope has been really good at providing those social protection services that really reduce someone's risk to HIV.
Why are young women particularly at risk of HIV?
So it's because young women have the least social assets in society. So they tend not to have strong social networks. They tend not to have economic assets. They tend not to have like educational assets. So because of those issues, they are vulnerable to HIV. They're more likely to get into relationships with older men in which they have very little power. So the older men may already be infected with HIV. They may refuse to condomize. The young woman might not have the agency to insist on condoms. She may not have the agency to insist on monogamy or fidelity. It might be that, you know, he has several partners elsewhere. They may fall into abusive relationships that they cannot leave because they're dependent on the partner. They have limited schooling because they may have fallen pregnant and not been able to complete schooling. There are all these reasons that make young women the most vulnerable to HIV. So even, you know, statistically, we can see that young women are 3 times more likely to contract HIV than young men. And it's because of those reasons.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
I think just that if we have an HIV or an AIDS-free population, everybody benefits. Business owners benefit, athletic centers benefit, leisure centers or hospitality sectors benefit because everybody is healthy. So we're better able to participate in our economy, and everybody wants to live in a country with a strong economy, and strong economies are directly linked to healthy populations. So I think that when we look at it like that and it affects all of our bottom lines, then I think we see it as an issue that we should all be concerned about and doing what we can.
And then lastly, your message to the public as we observe World AIDS Day?
I think my message would be to extend kindness to each other, to protect each other, to take care of each other. And that's the only way that we can really overcome this pandemic.
And that was Roseanne Kahure from Project Hope Namibia. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to All Things Public Health with Alvin Kapitako. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Spotify, Podbean, and other podcast platforms. Also, follow us on social media at All Things Public Health Podcast to engage with us.